really should have used them for painting white lines on highway docks. Kale pectate. You know, from the water. You get them poured of that stuff and run down the middle of the road. The poor Mexicans take some bed.
Yeah, so I'll put this light on.
Gee.
And I'll turn the other one on.
Oh.
Or I'll turn the hall on.
All right.
Oh, that's all right. You won't have to look at the light.
I tell you.
Yeah, listen, there's so much BS there, and it's all true. Why don't you just ask me some questions?
Okay. Did you, while you were serving as a gunner, did you ever have any pangs? Did you have a continuing wish you wanted to fly fighters?
I'd see the fighters sitting out there 5 miles, and I thought, damn, I wish I was in that sport. I wouldn't be a sitting duck.
Right.
Of course, the fighters had their problems, too.
Gee, some of those guys, I guess they didn't have hardly any training.
No.
They got
some on the job.
Well, I know, but man.
Oh.
Somebody was telling me they only had 60 hours or something.
Sure.
Hours, and they
well, they had the primary trainers. In both. And then they had an 86 advanced trainer, and then into a P-51. Zowie. He had to be pretty confident and pretty lucky just to survive, let alone get out there and get shot at and survive.
Did you ever fly one of those fighters?
No.
I didn't fly. That must be something fun. Yeah. Well, I can't really think anything down as far as questions are concerned on that part. I tell you what, let's swing over to Spud Morris.
Yeah, all right.
And that's the last
good
thing I want to get.
Listen, I taped the introduction.
Right.
Morris.
Now let me look here and see what
I don't waste the time.
Okay. But I got the tapes at home on Morris. I've got some.
Yeah.
Well, you've taped new tapes on Morrison here?
You've got some that I taped.
Yeah, right. I've got tapes on Morrison. But the thing about them is, they're fairly general, you know?
Yeah, well, here's the picture. See, I wanted to make sure that you knew
right. The
reason Stubb Morrison was in Alaska.
Right, right.
You found out that...
That's great.
That the reason he was here
right. Was
that he loaned his friend, his gambling friend, $10,000. Yeah? Okay. Now and then he got up here and he got to looking around and he says, hey, I kind of like this country. It has nice profiles of mountains, beautiful composition, tremendous game country, good hunting and fishing. He says, here's where I want to be. So about that time, I taxied this plane up. This is in spring of 48 now. I had a nice shiny new PA-14 that held four people. I had two plants and about two gas boxes full of tremendous rainbows, some of 5-6 pounds.
This is Merrill Field.
Yeah. By the old United Air Motor for Safeway hangar.
And you got that on the other tape.
Yeah. Well,
you took him up there for a day?
Right. And he said, this is for me. Huh. I'm going to deal myself out from under that laundry.
Yeah.
Move to Talkeetna. And then he looked around and he saw this old bucket of blood, the old bar.
Yeah. Where was that located?
Down at the end of the street.
Well, down
by the way,
by the
you
river.
Still see the blood stains on the floor.
Is that right? Is that that old sag roof thing?
Yeah.
Well, we went down there when we were back here sheep hunting last fall and went down there looking.
Yeah. With no windows.
Yellow
doors,
logs, kind of yellow logs. No.
Yeah.
Look like they're
color
painted.
Logs. Yeah. Well, anyway. He bought that thing, he just had a ball up here.
Huh.
But he was a real smart Irishman. He was good-hearted and smart, he was a pretty sharp operator. You have to be a professional gambler.
Somebody I was talking about said he specialized in dice.
Yeah, right. Well, at that particular time when the Mexican holiday took place here in Talkeetna, he gave the boys a lesson in how to roll dice once in a while when the stakes were high enough. But Also, there were all kind. There's all kinds of gambling games. There's variations of dice games, and there's poker games, and there's a faro game, and there's several numbers games, of which he was a master at all of the different types. But there was a particular pool game he was a whiz at. It's called Keno. Now, Keno could be a card game, but Keno is also a pool game. It's a numbers game in pool. And if you play that long enough, you can get better than the average guy, too.
But his wife is pretty good.
Tremendous.
She just died here a couple of years ago. Somebody was, Carol. Close was telling.
But,
Hey, Don, was she by any chance the lady that you had, let me think now, about 3 years ago, I think it was the first year, or 4 years ago, the first year we came down here fishing in the spring, you came out there and...
To the rainbow?
No, out to Papa Bear.
Oh.
And you had an elderly woman with you in the plane, just riding along with you.
She didn't just ride. But she was very Honolulu Samoan.
No, this woman had grayish hair.
No. That was a different
I just thought, you know, if I could remember what she looked like.
She was strictly Samoan.
Yeah.
Prominent and been a beautiful girl when she was younger. Huh.
And she stayed here all that time after he died?
Yeah. Well, see.
What did she do?
She taught. She is a tremendous teacher. She taught the old Hawaiian, old... Samoan dances with perfection.
Yeah.
And she could do them with perfection too. But her personality didn't allow her to be too sociable most of the time. However, she did the community a tremendous lot of good.
Was she?
The homemakers, and she taught the little ones from the age of 3 and the old ones up to 90 and had them all dancing. Beautiful Polynesian dances, and she just had to get to teach, and she was a regular magnet.
Did she do this right up to the time,
she slowed down in the last 10 years, but she'd look over the lineup, and people would come by and say, my daughter wants to get the Pearl Rendezvous dancing contest, teach her a few numbers and
go ahead now. She's shut
check
it down.
Her out.
I'll get you after. Okay, she's running.
Yeah, well, Morrison, he was originally from Yankton, South Dakota, and he had gone to Honolulu and became interested in a commercial fishing venture, which was very successful, especially with him running it. And in the meanwhile, since heavy, easy money flourished in Honolulu, it also followed that most everyone gambled to a point. So on one particular day here in Talkeetna, years later, in the Fairview Inn, the old bar across the street, there was this poker game in progress. And eventually that broke up, and it turned into a 4-5-6 game.
What is that 4-5-6?
Well, it's a dice game with three dice and a cup.
What?
See, so I didn't do too good in the poker game, and I did less well in the 4-5-6 game, and Morrison, he's watching all this, not saying a thing and not taking any part, just a small little game. A few bucks changing hands, and so after it was all finished, I was around in the back of the hotel cleaning a king salmon. It was in the springtime, big fat king salmon. We had two fish wheels at that time in action, and the big salmon would get hung up on the fish wheels, and we'd eat them and smoke them and can them and salt them and They were delicious. Anyway, Morrison said, he says, I noticed you didn't do too good in the poker game. I said, I didn't do too good. That's right. I lost about $35. And he said, you did less well than that in the 4-5-6 game. I said, yeah, I think I lost about $45 in that. Well, he says, I just want to show you something here. He said, now, we're going to play 4-5-6. If you got anything left at all? And I said, yeah, I've got $5 left. He says, I'm going to take that away from you in 3 flops if you play. Well, I said, well, how can you do that? Well,
nice guy.
He says, put her out here. So yeah. I say, fine, here's my last $5. So, we use the back of the fish board for splash board. Yeah. Now, it's a game that don't use a splash board is one you should watch, because the splash board helps keep the dice pitchers on it. Yeah. Well, anyway, I said, Morrison, what did you do to those dice? He'd never ace away. He'd always make his point.
Yeah.
And then the next thing would come up 4-5-6 and you lost your money.
Yeah.
All right, so I say, how do you do it? He says, you watch. I say, I don't see a thing. And we're using this back of the fish board for a splash board. He said, my God, I'll do it real slow. He says, now, here's what's happening. He says, obviously, you aren't going to be able to see what's going on, so I'll have to tell you. He says, you see, he's got a big hand about like yours, big Irishman. And he says, now there's 3 dice, right? I say, right.
Yeah.
He says, we're beating this cup to death with these 3 dice, aren't we? I say, it sure sounds like it. Boom! And into the splash board. Well, what did you see? Nothing. A lot of noise and a lot of razzle-dazzle and nothing. And that number said 4-5-6. How do you do it? He said, I'll tell you how to do it. You see? Now look here. Put 1 dice here, 1 dice there, and I hold them. And then I beat the box to death with the 3rd dice. Now already I've got 66 2/3 advantage over you, because I know what these 2 dice in my palm are going to say when they come out on that board. And the 3rd dice I can control into that splash board, and I set it there, but I think I know what it's going to read, but I might be wrong, but I still have the advantage of 2-1 over you. I say, well, I don't think I want any more to do with dice. He said, well, look here, I'm trying to show you how to protect your hand, not how to be the thief. He says, I just trying to point out why you're losing your money.
The other guys are doing
that. Well, they're in the word, 1 in every crew.
Yeah, right.
There are several in every crew. Now, not necessarily the guy that holds the dice is the one that wins the money. Not necessarily. I and you may be in partnership. You know what I'm going to pitch.
Yeah.
You bet on what I throw. I never saw you before because you're around there with your hat pulled over your eyes. And when I wiggle my right ear, why, you put your whole bundle out there, and I roll the numbers like 4-5-6.
Huh.
Or in don't ace away.
Yeah.
Or you bet on the number, and
he
roll the number.
Where did he learn to do that? I
mean, well, in self defense, he told me. He says when he was a small boy, he used to collect the rent in his father's apartments. But before he got to the end apartment, there would be no rent, because there'd be a big dice or a poker game in route, and then he'd have to answer to his dad, and his dad nearly beat him to death. But he never cured him.
Yeah.
Anyway, but all said and done, Morrison's a great outdoorsman, good-hearted, smart, public, and community-minded, helped a lot of people.
What was his appearance like?
He was, well, he was a little salt and pepper there at the age of 52 or 3. And,
he's a big man?
About 165. He'd been a tremendous specimen, but he'd also been in a car wreck and had his left arm nearly sheared off in the glass of the window or the windshield, and it crippled his left arm maybe 60%. But he was active and smart and strong and a good guy.
How did he take the plunge?
Good. He took.
Did you teach him or?
Well, he rode around there for about a month and he says, "Hey, give me this thing."
Is that right?
Yeah. And I said, "Fine." I say, "Boy, he sure did. He used to be a right racing driver, and speed and amazing. He wasn't chicken. He could think in a mind, and he just was a plain smart guy.
And under pressure,
he was really good. You had to be. He was telling me about switching the dice in Reno one time." In Harold's Club or someplace, and see, you got to do that with extreme caution or you're liable to get killed. Anyway, they switched their own dice in for one time around and then switch them out. And hit a tremendous lick with their own dice and then switch them in one at a time and out one at a time. And three different guys sitting around that dice table and be switching them in and out, see?
Right.
Loaded dice.
Oh,
and they got away with it.
Yeah.
I only say that not in a derogatory manner, and I don't condone being crooked. But what tremendous chances. I just illustrate the fact that he is tremendous under pressure.
Well, how many, he flew then, how many years did he fly?
Well, from 48 through 51. And he dove into the ground in a tremendous radiation fog.
Going to Anchorage, was it?
451, yeah.
What was it going to Anchorage?
Hauling the passenger to Anchorage.
Oh, passenger?
Yeah. Random airplane.
What kind of airplane?
It was a 1924 Bravo Brandon Super Cub. But it can happen to anyone.
Oh.
Listen, you just look at the lineup. Go down and look her up in the Fairbanks at the Anchorage office and see who's clobbered what and went with it. There's two Clark brothers out of Cantwell. I was shocked to know that the second one got clobbered last fall. Part of it's maintenance, and the rest of it's faulty pilot technique, and the rest of it's bad luck.
Yeah.
But you gotta have luck. Man, there's too many ifs. Can't leave things hang on chance and expect them to come out right. You gotta get in there at both feet and plant it, hopefully.
When you started flying, Don, this is just an aside here. When you started flying, did you just take to it like a fish, you know? In other words,
I never.
When you went up in a plane, were you totally comfortable and just, oh man, I want to do this?
No,
and
I tell you what.
Try anything, you know, this type of thing.
I never ever had any trouble with landing. I always. But maybe that was some background, too. There was an old guy that used to fly bush and fly the Travelers. I got a picture of one. Did you see it there?
Yeah.
The Traveler? 6,000. And Martin was his name. And I'd ask him, how do you get to the ground? Huh. And he'd say, depending on how fast the plane is, most of the big old planes go slow. He says, you look ahead and you get he went through the key position routine, which was well known even at that time. And he said, you judge the wind. And he said, you look ahead and you hold your airspeed. And he says, properly set up on a good approach, usually you'll make a good landing on a proper.
You do this, Don. Like
unconscious,
right? In other words, you don't say, well, let's see how I'm about where I want to turn base, just after the land.
Well,
and
you just kind of get a feel.
You just do it. See, I mean,
it's just like.
How about airspeed? Do you have to watch your airspeed on
YouTube? I never look at the airspeed. Oh, well, I'll take that back. Yesterday, I knew that I was fast. So on one of my rare occasions, I looked, and sure enough, I was about 5-6 miles an hour fast. But usually, you don't have to look.
But how about the sensation of flying?
Instrument flying is something else. You have to look because you're flying with the instruments. I'm talking about just VFR, Kentucky windage.
Well, when you first started flying, how about the sensation?
I knew what I wanted to do.
The type of thing that normally makes the average guy feel a little bit uncomfortable when he first tries it.
No.
The idea of taking off of the plane alone out over these dunes up here.
No, when you get over that.
Well, right, but I mean, did you have to get over it?
I knew what I wanted to do because I've ridden with the various Akon Christensen. He let me fly his Waco in 30. Spring 39 for short intervals of time, and I knew what I wanted to do, and I've watched the experts in action for years.
You'd made a decision at that time, in other words, make aviation life.
Well, I just wanted to make a path over the tundra without making snowshoe tracks in the bargain. Anyway, this is the country of the airplane. There's a few of them left. Canada and then New Zealand, Australia. Some place is left where you can
utilize
rich man's plaything.
Australia's got everything.
Yeah, but you can't take anything with you. You can make a fortune in Australia, but they will never let you get out of the country with any of it, I've heard. And things are restricted and tight. Like in Canada, they give you a certain area. In New Zealand, the same. They give you a restricted area where you're confined to a given area. See, the good thing about Alaska, for years, I used to go to Point Barrow every spring. January 6th, on a big fur buying deal for some of the furriers.
That was an annual deal.
Yeah.
How many years did you do that for?
Oh, from the 50s, I think 62 was the last trip I made. Anyway, and then USGS on the Yukon, fairway survey of the coast. That includes the Kudu Bay, Chocolate Sack, Yulaquit, Nome, Kotzebue, Bristol Bay area. On the USGS, I was there for about 10 years. Anyway, the CAB are re-examining the bush rock structures, and I think their plan is to confine the people to the area they fly mostly in, which is going to go over like a lead balloon. If I decide to go to Point Barrow with a load of people, or I'll take a load of fishermen to Bristol Bay, to Sir Lurk, or over the Wood River, why just go there non-stop in the float plane, see? And they're going to have a hell of a time shoving that down our throat.
If they plan
to do what I think they plan to do.
Well, it sounds like another move that they made way back when they first got established. I was reading some book, I can't remember where, everybody hated the FAA and they were the CAA.
My
father-in-law was one of the guys that really was.
Oh, he wrote them.
He really
wrote a Mexican standoff.
Yeah,
go ahead, Darren.
Okay, here's a big question. When and how did you first become aware of Mountain King?
Oh, you can't help but see Mountain King.
No, but I mean,
in 38, when I arrived here, I thought, there ought to be some gold in them Dar Hills. Later it became flying gold.
Yeah.
Later I made a few investments up in these mountains. Yes, indeed. But also some revenue. So in 38, in the fall of 38, you can see McKinley from Anchorage, and I saw this tremendous mountain sticking up. And I knew it was Mount McKinley.
You saw it from Anchorage?
Oh, sure. You
on your way up
from Anchorage?
Yeah.
On a clear day. Yesterday, you could see. Steve McKinley from Anchorage, and these five advertising media types took a good look at her from Anchorage just yesterday. But see, all around the whole Alaska range, on all sides, is a tremendous amount of evidence of gold mines and base metal mines. Uh-huh. On a Kantishna, there's the antimony, lead, tin, and zinc, and lead and zinc, and then Taylor is the next outcrop south of Red Devil Mine of tin. And then, of course, in the McGrath area, they did tremendous amount of hydraulic placer, and then on up the Nome Coast and over on the Koyukuk and the Cougar Rock, and on up in the Fairbanks area and east of the Fairbanks area and over into the Klondike Sea. So, but mainly this whole Cache Creek Fairview area in a big circle, and on the north side in the Kantishna, that's all mineralized country. And there's some big strikes still to be made in that area. Yeah. Hey, do you want something to drink?
No, gosh, no, please.
Orange juice?
Go ahead and have some if you want some. okay. What year were you born?
Oh, God.
20?
11? 21. Yeah.
Okay. I've got, like I explained to you in there, I've got the first chapter of the book, and it's your early life. Now, mind you, what I have to do, I have to sit down, Don, and you can probably visualize what it would be like trying to write this.
Oh, hell, you got to have some
time. I don't know you, I didn't know you at that time, obviously, and, I have to just, from what you say on the tapes, I have to assume what your interests were, what kind of a person you were at that time. So, if there's anything in your estimation that's erroneous about the thing, the point where you want to change, holler.
Uh-huh.
And tell me which it should be. Like, for instance, I made statements in it, for instance. One of the things I assumed when you were young, that you were very interested in natural history. You were interested in the animals, wild animals, game animals, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Just from listening to the tapes. Sure. And interested in...
Well, I was in the country of Wyoming. That was one of the best game areas of the whole world, or the whole West. That particular type of feed, the bunch grass, supported tremendous herds of buffaloes, antelopes, elk, and up higher the mountain sheep, and the smaller animals, and the fur animals, the predators, and naturally you'd be interested in it because you're right in the middle of it.
Did you do a lot of hunting when you were a kid?
Well, some.
I didn't get the impression you did from the tapes. You know,
trap line.
I assumed you'd trade.
Mainly because the price of fur was a supplement to a pair of shoes, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's about it.
Yeah.
All right, I can go. I got that will, plus the tape I've got on Morrison at home. I think that'll more than do it. Hey, did you get that tape number 10 finished yet? Or was there a number 10?
Yeah.
I've got tape number 9, and it ends with your cabin building project. You met a guy by the name of French Canadian, and the tape ends.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah.
Well, let me do the rest of it right now.
Okay, it was right. You said it was right when you. Wait a minute.
Well, look, this was Ira Dees.
Right.
We had worked. It.
No. Wasn't Ira Dees.
Well, wait a minute. What's
he
cabin
was your
building?
Partner. When you pulled out of the mine that you were working.
Well, Well, the reason I left.
Yeah, that's right. He's the guy that went to Anchorage.
Ira Dees.
Okay.
He's the lad that worked at the mine with Joy Brittell and
hurt
I.
His back.
Hurt himself
okay.
bad.
Yeah.
And was barely able to stagger in to make the cat train on its monthly trip to the hospital, or into town so he could make the train to go to the hospital. Anyway. The 30th day of August 1939 was the date that they just took a guess and an estimate that their water would be low, so they'd consider that as the closing date for the season at the Jenkins Mine. That's where the murder disasters took place, somewhere between the 1st of September and the 3rd of September.
Uh-huh. That wasn't on the way of tapes at all. So
yeah, well, here.
Yeah, do her up, because that's the end of my second chapter.
Oh, for Pete's
sake. I've got everything but that on the second chapter. And
well, but
anyway. Quit writing because I couldn't do it.
Yeah, all right. So this particular night of the 30th of August, 1939, it was a ominous, tremendous winds and rain and a downpour. And I had two loads, about 150 pounds of stuff, personal gear, boots, and things, that I'd hauled into the mine with a cat. But I wanted to bring out with me because I needed this stuff, I thought. When Deese and I was on this trapline cabin building project, we was going to get organized out by Coto River. Anyway, so after putting in this 10-hour shift at the mine, it was dark, getting dark and overcast then, and then it began a tremendous downpour rain. And I made the first trip, and I was just looking at the distance the other day. It must be about 6 miles both directions, 12 miles. So on top of the 10-hour shift, we've been working 10 hours all every day, every day of the week, all summer, from 1st of May at this mine. I made this 12-mile round trip with about a 75-80-pound pack. And then I thought, well, I'll leave that the rest of the stuff up at the mine, and maybe they can bring it out when they come up. And then I got to thinking, well, some of the things I have in my gear, I should have. So I made another 12-mile round trip, and I got back at 2 or 3 in the morning at this cabin. And sure enough, Deese was there. He met me on my first trip, and he was still pretty lame, this vertebrae problem. Anyway, then the next morning at 6 o'clock, here come this old cat train, and we loaded everything on it and headed for Talkeetna. And our plans were to get outfitted here with everything we needed. At that time, you'd have to cross the river in a boat. Well, anyway, this old-timer Weatherall run the boat and the cat service. But
now, that was on the Susitna.
That's this river right out
here.
Yeah,
right. You had to cross this when we came in on the cat train.
Because obviously it wouldn't have froze up in the first part of September. Anyway, we no sooner landed here than this new 4,000-foot present FAA State CAA Airport was being under construction, and we were immediately offered a job at I think $2 an hour. And here we'd been working for 50 cents an hour all summer. So we took it.
Yeah.
And
gave up your cabin building.
Well, for a short while, until the freeze hit, and then we decided to go on out in about the 1st of October, I think.
What did you want to build in cabins for?
Well, trap line.
Oh, I see.
So, anyway, we got lined out and got our gear. By then, now, it's into October, November, probably. And it's snowing and it's frozen up, and we got across the river on the ice, and we were pulling these two sleds. No, wait a minute. We was going to take two. We got one big sled with a G-pole on it, and one would pull and one would push. That's the way we got it out there. Hell of a load of stuff.
Jeez.
And we continued on and on until we went past Moose Creek, and we camped in that area, and once between there and Calhoun. But on the third day, the storm got worse, and it was a real tremendous blizzard. And we pushed our way along, and the sledding was tough, and it was on the old Cache Creek Trail. Anyway, so I say to Deese, let's just stop here. And we got into a good grove of dry spruce, and said, hey, instead of just, let's make this our base camp, because obviously the storm's going to last several days. So we went up about 6 logs high and then put a 10 by 12 tent frame over it.
Hmm.
And it lasted 3 days, the storm, 3 more days. Anyway, and then it cleared off, beautiful crystal clear, just 2 or 3 feet of fresh snow. And I was out cutting a tree down for wood, nice dry spruce, back of our new cabin set up, the first one of the lineup, and lo and behold, we'd been out of position about 5 miles, and about 300 yards behind us was a cabin that had been built 50 years ago. Belonged to old Matt Hamburg, the old trapper. But in the blizzard, we didn't know this. We just assumed we were in the wrong, where we were, and we were in the wrong location. But anyway, in about 3 weeks, we in the meanwhile had scouted up some other cabin sites. In about 3 weeks, in another tremendous blizzard, we heard a noise outside. We opened the door. It's about 10 o'clock at night, and it's just a blinding blizzard going on out there, and there's an old timer out there just in the, on his last legs under a heavy pack, and we invited him in and poured some hot coffee down his throat, gave him some moose stew, and finally we asked him what he was doing out in the blizzard like that. And he said he's trying to get to Talkeetna. Well, we told him he's about 18 miles from Talkeetna. Might as well hang it up for the night. He agreed to that, all right. So we put him overhead in this 10 by 12 cabin with the tent top. And we had 2 bunks in the bottom and some room upstairs. And a ladder going upstairs. And then about 3 or 4 in the morning, the wind howled, moaned all night, and it snowed a fit. And then the wind went down and I heard a noise, but I didn't pay any attention to it. And then when it got light, about 8 or 9 in the morning, I looked out and was amazed to see a set of snowshoe tracks taken off towards Talkeetna. It was this old caretaker's snowshoe tracks. He'd been a caretaker at this mine after they discovered the murders. And then all of a sudden, the commissioner...
See, now, let me interrupt you just for a second. What was he a commissioner of?
It's U.S. commissioner. U.S. commissioners.
That was his full title.
Yeah.
He was the old territorial commissioner then.
Yeah, U.S. Wait a minute.
Because you mentioned...
The territory was the U.S. commissioner. Anyway, his name was Ben Mayfield, and very fair.
He was the guy that you kind of bribed with moose.
Well, I didn't bribe
him. No,
I thought that. But anyway, he sent somebody out with a dog team. He told me to come to town immediately with the dog team because they wanted me to do a job in town for one day. And what he wanted me to do was identify the gold cleanups that the old man had found. Mm. Up at the mine, he was going to stay there all winter. They had a good supply of food, but the wood was starting running out. And there's a...
This is the Perkins mine, Jenkins mine.
Yeah,
people knew it worked for.
Well, they left this old guy as a caretaker. He's going to stay there all winter and watch the place.
And he's the guy that was coming out. Went through your cabin.
He
and left
came out. Yeah. And they had a big pack, and he had 7 big cleanups with him. And was packing that along with his personal gear, and about broke his back. Anyway, there isn't anything tougher to pack than gold unless it's mercury. Anyway, in a flask. What had happened was that he had plenty of food, but it was spooky. Wind would moan and whistle through the old cabin, that he stayed in, and that came and rattled, and he'd have nightmares all night.
Well, now, had he killed someone by that time?
He was.
I lost the thread of this.
See, wait a minute. When Mayfield went out there to investigate the murders and to try to pin it onto someone.
Which murders?
The Cache Creek murders. Mr. Jenkins, Mrs. Jenkins, Dick Francis, and Joy Bertel all got wiped out.
Oh, I didn't know that. You hadn't mentioned that. You hadn't mentioned that in the tape, see. So I didn't know. When was this brought to your attention? When did you find out that they'd got knocked off?
Well, I had been working on the airstrip here for a week, and word come in that the whole outfit had been murdered. It's unsolved to this day.
Hmm.
Anyway, in addition to those four, there was one other guy in the area, and he walked out. Now, there's the shadow of doubt is between he and his big French Canadian. Hey, why I thought you knew about it was I put all this on a tape. Maybe the tape didn't work.
No, it's full tapes. It may have run out.
Well, but wait a minute. Okay.
I've got up through tape 9.
Okay.
And you ended there. You said, now, at that time I met this big French Canadian, and he would figure prominently in the disaster that would follow.
Yeah.
The tape ended.
Okay.
And that's as far as I had.
That's right. He did figure it prominently. He discovered the murders, so he said. Whether he completed or discovered them is a matter of contention. But the thing is, they couldn't pin it on him. They took a big posse out there to look for evidence, including the FBI. And they couldn't find any incriminating evidence because they lived in the places and got them all tracked up and fingerprints all over everything, and so they just mucked it. So
were they murdered in the mine out there?
They were.
They were bludgeoned. Mr. Jenkins.
Mr. Jenkins and Joy Bertel were all bludgeoned. She was killed with an axe, and he was clobbered with a club, and the hired hand was clobbered with a club. Also, the old miner Dick Francis, who lived several miles over towards Ramsey, who had always been in legal problems with the Jenkinses over that rich ground they had, was found, and they said, well, this solves it, because Dick Francis murdered the whole outfit and committed suicide. And then the FBI got to looking him over and said, hey, wait a minute, boys, that's a good story, but how can you account for the single action 45 has been fired twice? There's two 45 slugs right over the top of Mr. Francis's ear, and you can't shoot yourself in the head twice with a single action 45, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing hung. And it was after they had been there for several weeks that a full posse of 10 guys, herding everything up in the camp and wrecking all the evidence, they decided that they'll put the caretaker there. This is where the caretaker came from. See? Then this old Yugoslavian caretaker, he staggered out of our place early wee hours of the morning in a blizzard, come to Talkeetna with his gold. Now, he found that gold. It was the gold, the complete seventh cleanups of the summer, because I identified it all in separate bags.
How did you do that? You know,
I could tell that he cleaned up seven cleanups.
That was there?
Yeah. Seven pokes of gold. So this is why they sent a dog team out to pick me up at our location in Gate Creek, where we built the cabin, or the old cabin that had been there for 50 years, to identify the cleanups, make sure they were all there.
In relation to Talkeetna?
It's about 15 miles off the Cache Creek Trail. Yeah. Anyway, the old timer had thoughts of keeping the gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got on a big drunk waiting for the train and spilled the secret and turned the gold into the commissioner.
how'd that pot liquor come by the gold?
Well, that's a good question, because I told you he had lots of food but was running low on wood. And he's fumbling around down in the wood box, getting that last stick of wood, and he run into the seven pokes of gold hitting the bottom of the...
In other words, up to that time, nobody knew the gold.
Nobody. They thought they'd been scounded with the gold.
Ah, I see.
So,
well, apparently these people
the motive for the murder remained unbeknown to everybody until the old guy found it in the bottom of the wood box. Huh. How about that?
Then there was no motive after that.
Well, that's right.
I'll tell you the one guy, and you couldn't have done it, because you shot twice and ended the same way.
When I was going to school in Fairbanks, I saw this clerk one day, and I wrote a friend of mine in Talkeetna and told him that I'd seen Clark in Fairbanks. And boy, it wasn't, but on the next train here, come the FBI trying to run him down. But he disappeared, and he showed up in a shipyard as a welder. Washington State. But anyway, an unsolved mystery to this day. It,